Where warp meets weft. Where warp meets weft. This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Welcome to episode 23, Alaskan Weaving. This episode, Weavecast goes to Alaska. Come with me for a behind-the-scenes tour to meet the muskoxen at the Large Animal Research Facility in Fairbanks. There, Sandy Garbowski, muskox wrangler, tells us all about these fascinating animals and how their kiviat is harvested and processed. Then, Della Cheney, a weaver of the Tlingit and Haida Nations, shares her people's traditions of weaving ceremonial hats and robes. Finally, we end up the episode and 2007 with some weaving resolutions for the new year. Last episode, I mentioned Peter Collingwood's rug weaving book and said that it belonged in every weaver's library. Now, tragically, that book is out of print, but Peter Collingwood has incredibly generously made both of his rug weaving books available online as downloadable PDFs. I will have a link to that on the show notes. I have a COE confession. I have looked at the stack of samples I have gotten done. And moreover, I have looked at the imaginary stack of samples that have not been done and realized that there's just no way I'm going to have things ready in time for the 2008 COE. Fortunately, I heard Mary Barrett talk about this very situation with regards to her COE work. And so it's only with a tiny, tiny bit of shame that I set aside my 2008 attempt and set my goals on 2010. What really decided me that 2010 was going to be my year was the fact that although I could probably cram and do each sample for 2008, I would just have time to do each sample once. And I really, for this project, want to do my very best work. Not just because I'm hoping to pass the COE, but because I want to feel like I've mastered each area of weaving that the exam covers. Instead of just doing a good enough tapestry, I want to do one that I'm really proud of. And that's probably going to mean weaving lots of tapestries, at least the way my tapestry is currently going. So if you are applying for the 2008 COE, I wish you the very best of luck, and I hope everything works out. If you're in my boat and you realize that 2008 isn't your year, come along with me and we'll set our sights for 2010. For our sponsor this episode, we welcome back Heritage Spinning and Weaving, and I am just delighted to have their continued support. I've never been to their shop. It's in Lake Orion, Michigan, so it's a bit out of my way. But I'm on their weekly email newsletter, and I must say, they have all kinds of fun there. Spin-ins, contests, sales, classes. There's even a weaving boot camp to get you up and running with weaving. I'm just so jealous of Michigan weavers. I hope that you guys are taking advantage of that wonderful resource you've got out there. I had the pleasure of meeting Joan Sheridan Hoover when she was passing through Seattle. And we had a delightful and adventuresome breakfast with her and some of her friends. And if you get to the Heritage Spinning and Weaving Shop, say hey to them from Weavecast. If you aren't in the Michigan area, do support your local independent weaving store if you are lucky enough to have one. Show up and give them the retail love. And now, we hunt down Kiviat on the Hoof, the large animal research facility associated with the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Sandy Garbowski. I work at the Large Animal Research Station. I'm a herdsman.
How did you get involved with the center?
I enjoy working around animals. I've been interested in alternative livestock. So I started out here as a volunteer to find out about raising muskoxen for Kiviat. And then they offered me a job. My husband was thrilled. It meant I wasn't bringing more animals home. So I've been here for about 5 or 6 years now.
How did you become the local Kiviat expert?
Well, originally what I was hired for was just for the combing. I was a volunteer, and I'd come out and help with weighing and feeding and things like that. Then they needed somebody to comb Kiviat that spring, so I was there. So I got offered that job. So Kiviat was actually the reason I was hired, and then I was just kept on for everything else.
Dare I ask how one gets a muskox to hold still while you comb it?
These animals are handled so much because they are research animals. They come through the barn every week and get weighed. They're pretty used to it.
How much does a muskox weigh?
The cows are about 500 pounds. The bulls go 700 or more.
This is really cool. We're in kind of a corral thing.
We'll go say hello to the ladies.
Ah, we're going to go see females. Oh, wow. These are amazing. They're smaller than I thought they'd be.
Yeah, people think woolly mammoth, bisons, things like that. They're more pony size. Big, heavy, fat, furry ponies, but
we're actually going into a pen where muskox are free. They have horns.
They do have horns. Even the cows have horns. What we have in here are all our adult females, our female yearlings, and then we have some castrates in here, too. They'll have a larger horn boss, and the horns will be tipped at the end, just for safety. We've got Anna Deer here with Timir right behind her, and it looks like Andre. Anna Deer's going to come over and say hello. She's one of our older females. I'm guessing she's 15 years old.
Oh, what a sweetie. How did they come to this area?
They became extinct in Alaska late 1800s. In the 1930s, they decided to bring some back in. They were brought from Greenland into New York, cross-country up to Alaska, down on the experimental farm for a couple years, and then out to Nunavak and released. No predators or anything, so they multiplied, did real well. So they've been taking stock off of Nunavak and putting it around the North Slope, Seward Peninsula, places like that, reintroducing them. What started as 34 animals is thousands of animals now.
Kiviat is the fiber, but the animals are the muskox.
Right. And Kiviat is not this outer hair that you're seeing on them, that we just call their guard hair. Kiviat is the fine underwool. I've actually seen it said it's from the underbelly of the muskox. No, it's not the underbelly. It's the underwool, but it is all over their whole body. It's on their faces, on their legs. Of course, it's not as long on faces and legs. Their whole body is covered with Kiviat. For hand spinners, what we save is the shoulders and sides because the guard hair is not too long there. The Kiviat's really thick and dense, and it's cleaner, although the whole animal is really clean. People are pretty surprised at how clean the Kiviat is when it comes off of them. Hey, Kiana, you going to come say hello? You can put your hand out to her. Yeah.
That's not smell good.
Okay. She says there's no grain there.
Ah.
And this is Odin. This is one of our castrates coming up here. You can see his horns are quite a bit larger across the top of the forehead there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot bigger than a female. And that's because the bulls would use them for butting heads. The cows use theirs more for, you know, they'll poke each other with the ends of their horns. They can actually pick up their calves and move them around. And if it's not their own calf, they kind of fling it. They definitely know where their horn tips are, and they definitely use their horns for various things.
Their feet are kind of interesting. They're very splayed.
That's for traveling on snow. They need a wide surface for traveling on snow. These guys won't travel through deep snow. They like windblown areas, things like that, where they can get to the feed underneath in the winter. Normally, they would not be found in the wild in this area. It's too warm for them in the summer.
What's their natural habitat?
North of the Arctic, windblown, open tundra.
When did people first start using the Kiviat off the muskox?
I don't think there was a big history of the Eskimos using it. I'm sure they must have used some because these guys will shed and it'll be caught all over on bushes and things, but I really don't know that it was used the way caribou hides and things like that have been used. John Teal was probably the most important guy as far as getting it started as a cottage industry, saying these animals can be domesticated, we can harvest the kiviet, we can use it. But obviously he'd heard about kiviet before that, so I don't know who was the first person who picked it up and said, this stuff's really cool.
To the modern hand spinner and knitter and weaver, it seems like a fairly new phenomenon. 10 years ago, you didn't see kiviet in the stores, and now it's starting to kind of filter its way down.
The marketing hasn't been there, and the quantities haven't been there. Ooming Mac, which is a cooperative down in Anchorage, it started based on John Teal, 50s, 60s, something like that. He wanted a way for them to have more cash income out in the villages, something that would fit into their lifestyle. The farm in Palmer is actually raising the kiviet. They send it out, get it spun. The yarn is sent out to the villages, and the women knit it there. They've been doing that for 40 years or longer. So it's been there. I think what's happened is they're harvesting muskoxen for meat in Canada up on Banks Island. And I think somebody pointed out that rather than just burning those hides, that there was some value in the kiviet. Well, it's becoming more available because, of course, now they're harvesting all the kiviet off those hides. They're not just throwing it away.
What a waste.
You know, but it's still, even with all those additional hides, there's still not a lot of kiviet available. There just are only so many animals. You can see these guys are really tame. They're really easy to work around. I'll show you the barn. They'll come in every week, cross the stanchion, get weighed. So to comb them, we just keep them in the stanchion. And, you know, if I'm pulling on their hair, they get a little grumpy about it, but that's to be expected. But they're used to being around people and being worked with. We consider them tame rather than domesticated. We have not really changed anything about them. We're not breeding for certain characteristics. These guys, other than the fact that they're so used to being around human, you could put them back into the wild and they're totally capable.
Yeah, they're an unimproved species then.
Right, there you go. That's a good word. They didn't need any improving.
When you're taking the kiviet off by combing, are you doing it all at one go or does it go over a period of weeks?
Because there's so many animals here, I usually have 40 to 50 muskoxen that need to be combed. They've got a synchronous shed so that they all, within 2 weeks, start shedding and all that kiviet comes out at once. The only thing I've got going for me is they've got that really long guard hair on there that's going to kind of hold it on them. What I tend to do is the younger animals start shedding first, so I'll bring them through. They need a little more time because they haven't been combed before. I might just take the prime kiviet, the shoulders, the saddle area, and the sides off of them, and then I'll send them back out so they don't have to stay in the stanchion very long. Those guys might come in 3 or 4 times for a full combing. These cows, as soon as somebody starts shedding, they kind of get rings around their eyes where the kiviet's come loose, start to see pups on their shoulders where it's starting to come out through the guard hair. And what I'll do is bring them into the stanchion, and I kind of check up in that saddle area, that light-colored kiviet, and I'll pull it a little. And if it's coming out, then I'll be able to comb them. I'll comb the whole animal except for the rump where the really long guard hair is. They hate having the rumps messed with. That's the least defensible part of that animal. They don't run from things that they're scared of. They turn around and face them. So I'll usually leave that, and I often leave the mane, which also has coarse crimpy guard hair in it, so the kiviet will sort of stick sometimes coming out. And I'll get that later. And sometimes I'll leave the belly on them too, because that's a lower quality kiviet. It's going to stay on for a while because they do have quite a bit of guard hair down there. But I'll try to get all of the neck, shoulder, sides, and quite a ways in under the belly, all of it out of the beard. Oh, that's another part that's fun to comb. But, you know, they don't mind that as much. Up on their neck, around their horn, their ears, going at their beard, I think they enjoy that. And plus, it can be hot here in May, which is when they all shed. Often they might not enjoy the combing quite so much, but it feels so good to get that kiviet off. I'm sure they just kind of go, ah, you know. Most of them get combed twice. Once I take the majority of it off, and then comb the whole lot of them, and then I'll bring them back in for what I call the cleanup. I'll get the rump, the mane, anything that was left on the belly.
How much do you get off of an animal?
We get 4 to 5 pounds an animal. Some of our castrates will go over 6 pounds. Of course, some of the younger animals, it's a little bit less. There's quite a bit of kiviet. It's not like a cashmere goat, you know, where you're weighing it in ounces. We weigh it in pounds.
But that's with the guard hair.
Guard hair does not shed when the kiviet sheds. Some guard hair is going to come out with kiviet, but when I get done, I don't have a naked animal. He just looks a whole lot skinnier.
The stuff in the shop, there was a processed bag and the unprocessed bag. And
yeah.
The processed bag looked like it had a lot of the darker guard hairs.
There's the dark guard hair, then there's a lot of intermediate fiber in there too, where the actual kiviet might be 13 to 15 microns, even finer, down to 11 microns. Then you get this other stuff that runs from about 15 to, oh, maybe 24 microns. It's crimpy at the end and then very straight and slick at the outer end of it. People tend to want to take that out. And of course, and then there's very coarse guard hair that's like human hair or heavier even. You don't want to leave that in at all because that would just make it itchy. But that intermediate fiber, I have seen things spun with it left in It's very fuzzy. What I like to do is pull all the coarse guard hair out, throw it away. There's not that much of it. The intermediate fiber, I save. I separate it, but I save it to mix with regular wool or something else because it'll soften it up, lighten it up, make it a little fuzzy, just make it a nicer fiber. And that way I don't have to throw out that much fiber that you just paid lots of money for. Where do you stop dehairing? And it kind of depends on what I'm making. If I'm just making a scarf or hat, I go through pretty quickly. If I were going to be making baby hat or something like that where I really didn't want it too fuzzy at all, I would probably dehair a lot more carefully. I figure I'd probably take 30% of the hairs out before I spin it.
What's your favorite thing to make with Kiviet?
I like hats. You can knit a band of wool or something, or a wool blend in. I like to do that. I like to blend some wool with some Kiviet for a band on it to give it a little stretch. Kiviet alone tends to sag. It doesn't have elasticity.
Which came first, the animals for you or the spinning and knitting?
I had done a little bit of spinning a long time ago. Didn't really like it, but a friend of mine was into it, so she talked me into trying it. And so I did a bit, and then I set it aside. Then when I started working out here with these animals, I started spinning again. Got a different drop spindle, really liked that. Then got a spinning wheel that I love.
What happens to the fiber that you harvest here?
Probably about half of it goes down to Umingmak for the Native Cooperative. Another quarter of it we save for hand spinners. We save all the prime stuff that's really nice without a lot of dandruff in it. A lot of the stuff that we comb does have dandruff, and most hand spinners really don't want to sit there and snip or pick all the dandruff out. So what we do with that is we tend to send it in and have the yarn that we've got up in the shop made, yarn or roving or something. It all turns into hay is what it does, so we can feed the animals here.
Right.
But we can go in the barn and I can show you more stuff. While I'm combing, it's great if people come in the barn because you can catch the animal on one side and they just feel like a teddy bear. You can't feel the animal underneath there.
Uh-huh.
It's just so fluffy. And then on the other side, where maybe it's been combed out, you'd smack and it's a solid animal. You know, you can hardly feel the hair at all. It's more like hitting your head or something like that. And they do. They lose several inches off them, so it looks like they've just gone on this huge diet. They look so skinny.
Do you have helpers when you comb?
Yes, we've got volunteers that come in and help comb. I especially have, you know, one friend down in Homer. I had actually gone to a spinning workshop that she gave in April up here. She'd been asking about Kiviet, and I said, well, gosh, we're going to be combing in May. She actually came back up from Homer, helped comb, wow. And she has come back every year since then. That's Celia Quinn. We also have some of her stuff up in the gift shop. She always buys some before she leaves, and we always give her first pick of whichever she wants.
When we walked into the barn, one of the things that drew my attention was the musk ox head stuffed and mounted on the wall.
Musk oxen come through here. This is a modified bison squeeze.
Somebody manufactures a bison squeeze?
Yes. And then modifies it. It actually makes it smaller. I think it's like about 2/3 size. But yeah, the animals come right in through the overhead door, come through here. If we've got, you know, a bull that's acting up, we can swing this whole gate behind him and force him to go in.
How clever.
Most of the time I just open the door, leave it open, and about half of them just walk in all by themselves. Go, okay, it's weighing day, you know, and they all kind of line up here and just walk through. And
they don't find the guy on the wall intimidating?
You know, when I first started here, I kind of wondered, and none of the adults ever looked at him, and then little calf came out, looked up on the wall, and thought, you know, I have no idea what she thought, but, you know,
it's,
I mean,
God.
She was the first one I had seen that actually looked up and real, you know, acted like she recognized that as being a muskox up there. And that is not one of our animals. That was one somebody had hunted out on Nunavak and donated the head mount to us. So.
The tallest muskox in the world. Is this some Kiviet?
Now that's off our calves. This is what they're born with.
Ooh.
They're actually born with a layer of Kiviet, which they then shed about this time of year, and they'll grow in their first winter coat.
Is this appreciably different than the adult Kiviet?
Yeah. Let me get you some of the adult Kiviet. And we do bag it up by each animal. We keep track of how much has been produced.
Oh, wow.
By each one. And, you know, it combs off. People sometimes can't believe that it's combed and not sheared because it combs right out as a fleece.
You know, you have just made my trip right here. I'm looking at an entire Kiviet fleece. Oh, my goodness.
And actually, this one's pretty nice. I don't see a lot of dandruff on it. And you can see there's not much vegetable matter in it. You know, there's a little bit of straw once in a while.
Wow. That is amazing. Does anybody do anything interesting with the guard hairs like they do with horsehair?
I don't think so. This is the guard hair.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of amazing that comes off the same animal.
That feels just like horsehair.
Yeah.
I was reading online recently about some special Swedish techniques where they do horsehair weaving.
Oh, yeah. Somebody like that could get a hold of some of this and probably do something beautiful with it. Last year we sent a random sample of different ages down and had the fiber tested for micron diameter. Our yearling fiber was actually coarser than our adult fiber. Flip this over and you can see the other side. There's a little bit of guard hair. That's probably stuff I would throw away, I wouldn't keep. Then you get this intermediate stuff. It's still pretty soft, nice fiber. It's not Kiviet. It's not this super fine, but it's a very nice fiber.
Gosh, this stuff is so nice. I can't believe I just see a whole Kiviet fleece here.
Oh, stick your arms into it. I mean, it is so light. You know, people go, it's how much a pound? But a pound will fill a laundry basket.
That is light. That's just amazing. It's like lifting down feathers.
What we use is we use an afro pick to comb these guys. I don't like the plastic ones. We tried that.
Oh, here's one of your combs.
Oh, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
What we've been doing, because we use a small mill for processing, so we keep all the animals' fibers separate. We'll have Annie's yarn or Anadir's yarn or Zane's yarn or whoever. All the coarser stuff, the stuff off the rump, the belly, things like that that we're not going to sell to hand spinners or we're not going to send to the little mill that processes ours, we can send that down to Umingmak. They use a big commercial mill, a cashmere mill, and they don't have any problem handling it. Then again, they send them 1,000 pounds at a time. We're funded through the Institute of Arctic Biology. We are part of them, part of the university. Most of our money comes from there. Any additional money we can get from tours, the sale of Kiviet, all go directly back into the facility, buying hay, paying my salary, things like that. It is expensive to maintain the animals. We also get donations from visitors. A number of the summer visitors that come through will leave small donations. We've had fairly large donations. On our scale of things, nobody's given us, you know, millions of dollars. But, you know, hey, if somebody leaves a 20 or a 50, hey, that's good with us.
Do you ever do mail order of the Kiviet fiber and supplies?
Oh, yeah. If they go to our website, they can click a link and get right over to the Kiviet, and it'll show what we've got available at that time, because it really varies. We almost always have raw Kiviet until late spring, right before combing. We'll run out then, but through the Christmas season, at any rate, we've always had Kiviet available in the raw form. Roving, we've just started offering because people have wanted stuff already dehaired, ready to spin, so that's kind of new. We're trying that. And the yarn, we've worked with a couple different mills. We've got a mill we're really pretty happy with right now. Mm-hmm. They can check the website, though, and see what we've got.
So it'd be a way to get some really delicious yarn or roving and treat yourself, but also support a really worthy research facility that's studying these animals and how to improve their lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
Next, Sandy tells me there is some audio I have got to record. The sound of a bull muskox defending his turf.
Okay, so we've got our breeding bulls over here. Zane is our dominant bull, and he almost always roars at me when he sees me. Zane-o! That looks like you right there. Come on. Hey, bud. Here he comes. When they go into full rut, it's amazing. They'll hit heads. You can hear it over this whole place. I've heard that on the tundra you can hear it, you know, miles away or something. I'm not sure if that's true, but I mean, I can believe it. It's a very loud sound. And they roar. If we can get him to roar, they'll kind of walk and tilt their head and show their horns. He might have to stop and pick up something on his horns. For some reason, they love to have junk hanging from their horns. And they start to smell this time of year. If you've ever been around goats, bucks, yeah, the muskox kind of get sort of the same smell. And maybe that's where people got this musk idea from. I'm not sure, but... Come on, Zane. You got company. Come say hello. He always comes over here and he'll make a liar out of me today.
He's probably afraid of microphones.
Probably.
That's awesome.
This is the strut. He's got the head tip curved out. He's trying to impress you with how large he is.
You are large. I'm very impressed.
And you notice we don't walk into the pen with these guys.
No.
Oh, can you? We're getting a little breeze. Can you smell him?
I'm smelling that.
Zane, we want you to roar again. Will you do that for me? Let's walk down the fence line, see if he'll roar. You need to get this.
Okay.
That's just some food. If you were in a tent and heard that, you would not stick your head outside expecting to see an herbivore. You would be expecting to see a carnivore of some sort out there, and you probably thought you might be lunch.
Yeah, you're right. That did sound more like a tiger or a lion.
Back again.
That was the most amazing sound.
And as the rut goes on, you get into September, that will get very loud.
I like how he's got the little bit of thing hanging from him. It's kind of like, you know, yay, look, I can gore things.
Oh, sometimes they get a whole wad of just muddy, messy, whatever they can find to hang on their horns. And if you take a look while you're up in the tour area, see these green panels that we've got for fencing here? Solid steel. There's a bent one up there. That was one of our bulls during the rut that decided he really needed to smash something. And then another year, this corner here that we've got the guardrails up so that they hit the guardrail before they hit the fence now. One of them, he'd broken all the welds off the end of the fence there. I had to push the tractor up against it to keep him in the pen.
That's like the same guardrail stuff you use for cars on bridges.
Yeah. That's where we got it. It's surplus guardrail that they'd taken down, and so we were able to pick it up and bring it over and use it for muskoxen, and that's pretty effective. I mean, it's amazing what they can break. I mean, if you look at the steel panels, they hit it a couple times, and it looks like it was hit by a truck and it was hit by an animal.
Small but mighty.
Zane is 7 or 8, maybe even 9 years old. 5 is young prime animal. You start getting 10, 12, and you're talking a very old bull. Females can live 20. We've had them over 20 years.
Can I go see what the babies look like?
Sure.
So did you ever think you'd grow up to be a muskox wrangler?
No. But I always knew I'd be around animals, so.
Yeah.
Once you meet these guys, and especially after you've worked with the fiber a little bit, it's kind of hard to go to anything else.
Yeah. And
especially when I know personally which animal all the fiber came from. When I buy it, I'll buy a little bit from this one. You know, like the first year I bought a pound, but I split it up between 5 animals so I could try young animal, old animal, cow, bull, the whole bit, to see if I could tell the difference, and I really couldn't tell the difference.
Is the fiber pretty much the same from year to year, depending on the animal?
I think so. We haven't done any long-term studies, and we just started last year. We sent some samples in and got them processed. I've got a whole box of samples this year to go in and get processed. There has been some research done by one of the people here at the university. She looked at a large number of animals, and it seemed to indicate that the fiber diameter actually coarsened a little bit over time, but we're only talking 1-2 microns. The bulls also had slightly coarser fiber than the cows, but still not a lot.
And what's the micron range for Kiviat?
I had to show you the graph. It's really kind of weird because it's really one-sided because they've got all that intermediate fiber. Basically, it averages out around 12 or 13 microns. Up to 15 microns, but there's fiber in there. You know, if you look at the little graph that they give you, it starts out at about 4 microns. And it peaks probably around 12 or 13, but then it runs all the way out to forever out the other end. I dehaired some samples and sent them in just to get some kind of an idea of how much I was pulling out. I tended to pull out everything over 20 microns. So here's Uka, uh-huh. And that's her baby.
Cute.
That's a little boy. They're about 3 months old now. When they get to this age, the cows aren't anywhere near as protective, but for the first month or so, they are very protective.
All of the animals here, none of them go out to slaughter?
No. No. No, they're born here, they die here.
How do you keep from reaching capacity in terms of grazing?
We buy hay and bring it in
if
we run out of grazing, and of course, through the winter, they're fed on hay. We control the breeding, too. It's not like every cow gets bred every year. We sort of determine what we need to keep a good variety of ages here, and like this year we've got 3 calves. We have sold a few animals. We have just recently donated one to the Alaska Zoo. Their bull had died, so we donated a young bull to them. So we do have some animals leave that way too. But for the most part, they're born here, they die here.
I just can't get over how cute they are. Grown-ups are cute, babies are cute.
And he'll have little nubs underneath there, just the start of his horns. Yeah. And then, I don't know if you noticed on the yearlings, they've got little stubs that stick out the side of their head. Mm-hmm. Then they sort of look like bicycle handles, and they kind of they curve and start coming forward. And then, at about 3 or 4, start drooping down. If you saw that little guy with no horns and without the long guard hair, you'd look at him, and if they weren't standing right next to Mom, you wouldn't know what animal they were. You'd be like, what is that? You know, that's the ugliest dog I've ever seen. You know?
Overall, it was a delightful afternoon, and I am so grateful to Sandy and Lars for granting me such a great behind-the-scenes interview. If you want to see muskox and their babies, check the Lars websites for tour times, and a link to their Kiviat store will also be in the show notes. If you're interested in the Umingmak Cooperative and want more information about that, you can go reference their website or read Arctic Lace. It's got the history of the co-op, information about the reintroduction of the muskox, and contains several Kiviat knitting patterns. Now, I had a wonderful time traveling through Alaska, but not everyone does. So here's another take on the great state of Alaska.
You're the one who broke the water filter in the first place. And don't think I can't see right through the guilty look on your face. Stomp off in the woods alone, wait and find out if I can. But don't come crying back to me when you surprise a grizzly bear.
Yeah.
Try to talk us out of this. After 3 weeks on the road, I'm feeling like an idiot. Staring out the window as I am, put my hands in my lap. I don't want to pick a fight, instead I color in the map. To be this isn't what they show you on TV. One bad restaurant and a pool. One time drunk who's got a grand plan and a cop with attitude. There's nothing beyond the town but big blue sky and fat straight lines. There's a subtle sticky thing that somehow makes me feel confined. Superhighway has become a two-lane dirt road. It's only 100 miles until the next Amoco. When we see our first black bear, I dropped a camera on the floor. When you laugh at me, I know that this is why we came here for.
I'm here in Fairbanks, Alaska. I've just walked a couple of miles through 80-degree heat, which shows how far I will go out of my way to a weaving store. I'm at a weaver's yarn, and I have dropped in on Susan and Martin Miller, who've been incredibly welcoming in true Alaskan spirit. So welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Sign. This is a pleasure.
Howdy. Nice to see you.
This store, it looks like it's part of your house?
It is. It's the front room of our house. When we decided to open up the shop, we actually looked for a house where we could have a good-sized show floor for the shop. It's got an attached garage that we turned into a classroom. When I'm not playing with fiber, I'm a polymer clay artist. I do a lot of cane work. And Martin is a tapestry weaver.
I am primarily a tapestry weaver. I'm a third-generation weaver. My father finally admitted that he also weaves. Mm-hmm. My mother does weave, and my grandmother wove. I do some work on a floor loom, but I enjoy tapestry the most because of the pictorial and narrative aspect.
What's your biggest inspiration for your tapestries?
At the moment, flowers. I do a line of note cards in conjunction with Susan that we take around to craft shows, and we've started a wildflowers line. It's all Alaskan wildflowers. And I've been looking at some of those and at some other flowers off the Mille Fleurs tapestries out of France and Belgium. And I've been working on some of those designs.
Were you both fiber artists before you met?
We met at Convergence in Minneapolis. We were in a workshop together. We were sitting side by side because Susan got up and moved over next to me. We dated during Convergence a couple of times and continued dating through the internet and through long phone calls. And it was not that much longer after Convergence that I was back in Minneapolis and we were getting married.
See, one more reason to go to Convergence.
He very carefully avoided the one thing about which we always disagree.
And that is?
That is the fact that he picked me up in this workshop. Oh. He seems to think I picked him up, and he would be wrong.
I think all good romances start with the other person feeling picked up.
She may have a point.
There is that.
Looking around, I have to wonder, is it dangerous having a weaving shop downstairs?
That was probably Martin's biggest concern, which he did not voice until about 6 months after we had opened the shop. He was afraid that every box that came in, about half of it would get squirreled away into my private stash.
It was a calculated risk.
But I discovered very early on, I could wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and if I really needed that skein of red yarn or that purple floss or whatever, I could just come out here and get it, so I didn't need to squirrel it away.
There are some of the things that are in the shop that I really don't want to let go of, but will, because we can always order more. A big thing that we have is with our handcrafted items. We have a number of talented woodworkers who are supplying materials for the shop. We have Jim Hoke at Woodworks, tapestry combs, drop spindles. We have a local artist, Diane Renee, who did some chip-carved tapestry beaters and pickup sticks for us.
Out of local birch.
And we've just gotten a new line of knitting needles in from
Gary Pollard. He hand-shapes knitting needles, and the points are just lovely. They have such a nice taper on them. I'm so happy with them. They're all out of exotic hardwoods. There's some bloodwood, there's some chuktacoke, which I hadn't seen before, some Osage orange.
These are very lovely. See, these are good shop owners. You know, they describe beautiful things and then they put them directly into my hands. It's a little bit evil, but I forgive them that. Tell me a little bit about the weaving and spinning and fiber community in the area.
We have a lot of people who spin dog hair with all the dog mushers around. Lots of people have lots of dogs with lots of hair. We've discovered that some breeds spin beautifully. Great Pyrenees spins beautifully. The junior grand champion at the fair for weaving and spinning division this year spun a really lovely lace weight skein of Samoyed hair that then she dyed purple, and it's just beautiful and beautifully spun.
Do you have an active guild in the area?
We have an active weavers and spinners guild. It's usually got 30 to 35 active members, and then a number of associates who are inactive because life intervenes. We have some folks who have been in the area, joined the guild, and then moved as far away as England, but kept their guild membership active to keep getting the guild newsletter. Our guild offers some workshops throughout the year for adults. We offer classes for elementary and high school students during the school breaks. We also have a couple of very talented basket makers who teach traditional basket making.
Do you do mail order as well as retail?
Yes, we do. We do have a website, www.aweaversyarn.com. We don't have any active selling off that, so there is no cash register or anything, but it does give our contact information. We have folks as far away as Colorado who are mail order. We also have folks around the different villages in Alaska where the mail plane comes in once a week.
Thank you very much for letting me drop in on you and doing an impromptu interview.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Glad to meet you.
Next up, we speak with Della Cheney, who is of both the Haida and Tlingit peoples. She tells about her experiences weaving with cedar bark.
In our community, I like to introduce myself in our language. I am a Haida and Tlingit woman. My Haida name, Scott Daskawas Hinu Dikiang in Tlingit Kasa Wa Yuhat Duasal Yeh Nahasati Kajadi Ayahat Zakwedi Yadi Ayahat Kakes Kwan Ayahat. My Tlingit name is Katsawa. I am of the Raven people, of the freshwater marked salmon. I am a child of the killer whale, and I'm from Cake, Alaska. Hawa, thank you in Haida. Gunashchish, thank you in Tlingit for listening to me today.
What would you call the name Della Cheney, then, if it's not your Haida name and not your Tlingit name?
Some people call it our tax name.
Okay. Well, your tax name is Della Cheney.
Yes.
And you've been a weaver since 1993. How did you become a weaver?
My mother is Haida, originally from Queen Charlotte Island in Canada. And her mother was a weaver of red and yellow cedar bark. So I watched, when I was in eighth grade, my grandmother Lucy harvest the cedar bark. She was about 88 years old and took us out into the woods and started to cut into the tree. She was speaking in Haida. I couldn't understand her, but my mother translated. So I watched as she did it. The strip of bark travels up the tree, and she was shaking the bark out like she was shaking a wet towel. And the strip traveled up the tree about a foot at a time. And it must have went up about 30 feet and might have been 6 or 8 inches wide. So when it got up to about 40 feet, then she had to break it off. Well, how do you break off a strip of bark? It's difficult. There's tricks. After you twist the bark, then you jerk on it to try to pull it off the tree. My grandmother was about 4 feet 10 at the time. And she might have weighed 80 pounds. We were standing on the left side of the tree, and she was twisting the bark so she could jerk it and try to get it down. Instead, she got my attention by swinging to the right side of the tree. Her whole body swung on the bark. Just as she did that, she called me over to her when she landed and told me to twist the bark again. And then, since I was young and strong, my mother was translating for me, I should be able to pull the bark off the tree. Well, it didn't happen. I jerked on the cedar bark and it didn't come down. So she walked to the middle of the tree and twisted it more, and then had me come over and jerk on it again. While the bark started to come down, it did break off finally and came down like a ribbon floating through the sky coming down to the ground. And I think that's when I became a weaver, because my mind's eye now could see how it began. And I watched her break off the outer bark and then split the bark. And then we carried it home. There we stripped the bark into widths that she could use to make baskets or hats with. I didn't weave with her at that time, but I did sit and watch my mother begin her weaving when she was 83. She was losing her sight. She was a teacher for 30 years and raised 11 children. So She didn't have much time for weaving. But when she retired at 76, she enjoyed just doing what she wanted to do, and that was travel. And then she came home and wove until she finished 3 baskets. My dad would bring her food so she would eat, because she was in a hurry to finish those baskets. And I saw how beautiful they were and how quickly she had learned. As soon as I was able to, I took a class in it. When I was in college in 1993, I was taking a course at the University of Alaska Southeast, a basket weaving course with Janice Criswell. She was my first weaving teacher to sit down and actually try to weave with red and yellow cedar bark. So that's how I began to weave, and I've been weaving ever since.
What is the significance of the hats that you make?
Making it for my family. I have made over 50 hats now. One of the hats won a second place prize in traditional weaving juried art show at Sea Alaska Celebration 2004. And that was the first recognition that I received in doing any of my artwork. And that was after about making 30 hats. I believe that's when I started to really see how important it was to our people to have people who could weave so that our dancers could wear the traditional regalia that had kind of slipped away from us as we came into the Western world and lost some of those things because of public education.
Could you describe what the hats look like?
Well, you've seen straw hats that you could buy anywhere nowadays. Some of them turn up at the brim, and some of them straight down. And that's how these hats are. They're maybe about 6 or 8 inches in diameter at the top. As you weave down, the diameter increases until you get down to the bottom of the hat, which is about 16 or 18 inches in diameter. When you're weaving down on the hat, just about in the middle of the forehead, you add in some extra warps on the inside, under one of the wefts. And those warps will be about, 4 inches, 6 inches long. Sometimes I make them extra long because it's easier to weave and you don't run out of the warp when you're making the headband. And then you continue weaving down the hat until you get to the base of the hat, which is about 16 to 18 inches in diameter. And when your hat is finished, then you can turn the hat inside out and weave the headband to whatever size it is that you want. So the headband is part of the hat, not sewn in at a later date.
Interesting. So you can start the hat before you have the exact measurements of the person you're making it for?
Yes.
We've heard about gathering of the cedar. After that part, what goes into the making of your hats?
After you prepare the material, splitting the bark down, then you pull it through a leather stripper to make them wide enough to fit the piece you want to weave, whether it's a hat, a basket, a placemat, or whatever. then when your materials are all ready, your red and yellow cedar, you could sit down and weave. It takes time to get the material down to the size that you need to make something beautiful. But sometimes I work on wide pieces of bark, like 1-inch width, to make larger baskets. Those are made very quickly because of the width of the strips of cedar. And when you get all your pieces ready to start your weaving, and whether you're going to use a pattern or not, then you could sit down and weave. Of course, you should not be feeling sad or angry. The place that you're working in needs to have a quiet place, no noise. And then just sit down and weave. Have you woven with cedar bark?
No, I haven't. I'm intrigued by the idea, but I don't know how to do it without hurting the cedar trees.
There's a little store you could buy cedar bark from. Basket Studio, I believe it's called. Anyway, it's in Squim.
Oh, okay.
And I think she might even have a cedar bark basket kit. It's something you could teach yourself if you already know the techniques of plaiting and twining. Because you could do either one. You could plait the basket, or you can twine, or you can use red cedar for the warps and yellow cedar for the weft.
Does the red and the yellow, do they look dramatically different, or is it subtle?
They're dramatically different, even when you feel them. The red cedar looks more red, of course, and the yellow cedar looks yellow. Not real yellow, but not white either, like a tannish color. But sometimes you could get them really white.
You made a very special hat to celebrate your mother's life. Could you tell us about that project?
I need to say Hawa and Gunashchish. Thank you very much to the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage. They invited me up to visit their center and to demonstrate how to weave a red and yellow cedar hat. They purchased the material so that I could come up and begin the weaving. While I was weaving, I spoke with the tourists and talked to them about what I was getting ready for. And my mother died in 2005. She was 93 years old. Her Haida name is Nungkwi Gagit Tianan, and her English name is Mona Catherine Ingram Jackson. I hadn't said her name for a while. She had been a teacher for 30 years in Cake, and she had 11 of us children and adopted 9 others. So there was a lot of people that we needed to invite to celebrate her life. The Tlingit people call it Ku'ich, a memorial party, because she belonged to the Salvation Army Church. We call it a celebration of life. So we were getting ready for that big Ku'ich. I wanted to weave 8 hats. I wove 6 hats. The first week I was in Anchorage from July 17th. Through that week I worked and almost finished the hat. And Saturday I became ill and had to be admitted to the hospital. So when you're sick or tired or angry, or don't weave. But I had the weaving in my mind, so my mind was busy thinking about how we were going to do the party. the hat that I was weaving for the party at the Alaska Native Heritage Center, I finished after the party. But I had those other 6 hats ready to go. 4 of the hats were gifted to my sister-in-laws, Edna, Julie, Ellie, and Anne. They were gifted the hats because of their loving ways and the way they are with my brothers, but also for holding us and helping us take care of my mother when she was bedridden for about 5 or 6 years before she left us. So my sister-in-laws would come down and cook dinner or bring dinner that was already cooked down to mother's house, or they would bake her desserts, which she loved. So these hats were gifted to my sister-in-laws. One was gifted to my husband because he helped me so much when my mother was not well. And he built me a loom so that I can do some raven's tail weaving on it also. But he received the hat because of his helping my mother in her bedroom get it fixed up so we could care for her at home. So he was gifted a hat. And I couldn't part with my hat that won the 2nd place traditional prize at the Sea Alaska Juried Art Show. So that hat is mine. So we had a wonderful party gifting to my sister-in-laws and my husband the hats that I did finish. So I have another hat that I have here. And then I have one that's almost finished again, so I'll have 2 more hats finished shortly. But that's what I used those hats for. In our community, the Haida and Tlingit community, there are really 2 families, the raven and the eagle. In the Tlingit community, my mother is a raven because they adopted her into the raven clan. And my father's the eagle, because that's what his mother was. But in the Haida clan, where we're from, where my mother's from, she's eagle of the hummingbird. When there's a problem that enters into the home of one of those families, when my mother died, the eagles came to take care of the ravens, her children. They helped pay for the whole funeral things, casket, transportation, food. So everything was taken care of. They fed us when we were hungry. They were with us when we were sad. So the Kuik then gives us an opportunity to gift them back for having helped us when we needed their help. So we gifted our eagle, my sister-in-law's our eagle. So we gifted them and their family members with the gifts we made. Since my mother died, we've all been very busy making gifts. So we paid them back by gifting them and feeding them for having taken care of us.
So what are you going to work on next?
I just wanted to say I finished the raven's tail robe for my daughter Liz. Her Haida name is Lagwanai, and her Tlingit name is Katspas. And she graduated from Arizona State University with her law degree. So I started a raven's tail robe when Mom was alive. But I couldn't weave because she died after I finished the third row of the pattern. So I didn't know if I'd finish it in time for Mother's kuish to gift it to my daughter. But things worked out, so I did finish that raven's tail robe.
And the raven's tail robes are woven on the warp-weighted looms?
Yes.
And it's a...
a wove robe. The raven's tail uses mostly geometric patterns. They're beautiful. My oldest daughter, Gail, is working on her doctorate's degree. I think she has 3 years left. She's challenging me, I guess, to make a Chilkat technique woven robe for her. My mind's eye has been quite busy. You gotta have a clean house. You gotta work through your spirit to clean everything out and work through personal problems, whether you have financial situations, you have to keep those up to date so those things don't get in the way of learning new weaving techniques. So I'm trying to get my house ready so that I could begin to draw the patterns and graph them out and decide on color. And then hopefully find the material I need to start the robe. So that's my next big project. There was a woman who was teaching my daughter how to weave the raven's tail technique, but she was from Holland, and she was a Dutch woman who travels around in the summertime. It's amazing that there are so many weavers out there learning the different techniques of weaving from different parts of the world. And I'm just thrilled to have spoken with someone who can share it with the world, some of the things that are inspiring to us and that still amazes today, that people who were not educated, but people who lived off the land could make such beautiful, intricate things just from their environment. So I really appreciate sharing my time with you. And I'm just thankful that there are weavers in the world who can help take care of the environment the way we have been. It takes so much effort to change. I know I changed when I started to weave, so I know it's possible for people to change.
To end this episode up, this being the end of 1 year and the beginning of another, I always think about my goals for the upcoming year. And one set of goals are my weaving goals. I'm thinking about making Fridays COE Weaving Day so that I can keep making progress towards that 2010 COE. Another weaving goal, I want to challenge myself to tackle those areas that still intimidate me. If you've listened to the first episodes of the show, you'll know that early on I had to overcome my fear of warping. Well, let me tell you, that wasn't my only fear. I have discovered a deep-seated fear of tapestry, fear of sewing. Actually, that's more of a fear of actually getting close to fit as opposed to looking like a flour sack. And of course, there is going to be another year of Weavecast. I'm having too much fun to stop now. I want to say a big thank you to all the guests and listeners who shared their time with me in 2007. Without you, there is no Weavecast. thank you for making this show a success. And I hope you'll spend more time with me in 2008. That's all for this episode, and now it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. Weavecast is brought to you through the generosity of its donating listeners. This episode, we'd like to thank Catherine. Our sponsor this episode was Heritage Spinning and Weaving. Additional funding comes from the Hand Weavers Guild of America and the Seattle Weavers Guild. Our background music this episode was Aurora Borealis by Technetium. We also played Alaska Song by the Buffalati. These artists generously shared their talents through the PodSafe Music Network.